Chapter 7. The last time I have the dream, it goes like this. I'm falling, tumbling through the air, but this time the darkness is alive around me, full of beating things, and I realize that I'm not surrounded by dark, but have only had my eyes closed all this time. I open them, feeling silly, and at the same time 100,000 butterflies take off around me, so many of them, in so many brilliant colors, they're like a solid rainbow, temporarily obscuring the sun. But as they wing higher and higher, they reveal a landscape below us, all green and gold and sun-drenched fields and pink-tinged clouds drifting underneath me. And the air around me is clear and blue and sweet-smelling, and I'm laughing, laughing, laughing as I spin through the air because, of course, I haven't been falling all this time. I've been flying. And when I wake up, it's wonderful, like I've been carried quietly onto a calm, peaceful shore. And the dream and its meaning has broken over me like a wave and is ebbing away now, leaving me with a single, solid certainty. I know now. It was never about saving my life. Not at least in the way that I thought. And on the seventh day, I remember I once saw this old movie with Lindsay. In it, the main character was talking about how sad it is that the last time you have sex, you don't know it's the last time. Since I've never even had a first time, I'm not exactly an expert, but I'm guessing it's like that for most things in life. The last kiss, the last laugh, the last cup of coffee, the last sunset, the last time you jump through a sprinkler or eat an ice cream cone or stick your tongue out to catch a snowflake. You just don't know. But I think that's a good thing, really, because if you did know, it would be almost impossible to let go. When you do know, it's like being asked to step off the edge of a cliff. All you want to do is get down on your hands and knees and kiss the solid ground, smell it, hold on to it. I guess that's what saying goodbye is always like jumping off an edge. The worst part is making the choice to do it. Once you're in the air, there's nothing you can do but let go. Here's the last thing I ever say to my parents. See you later, I say. I love you, too, but that's earlier. The last thing I say is, see you later. Or actually, to be completely accurate, the last thing I say to my father is, see you later. To my mother, I say, positive. Because she's standing in the kitchen doorway holding the newspaper, her hair messy, her bathrobe hanging wrong, and she says, "Are you sure you don't want breakfast?" Like she always does. I look back when I'm at the front door. Behind her, my father is at the stove, humming to himself and burning eggs for my mother's breakfast. He's wearing the striped pajama pants Izzy and I got him for his last birthday, and his hair is sticking out at crazy angles like he's just put a finger in an electrical socket. My mom puts a hand on his back while she squeezes past him, then settles at the kitchen table, shaking out the newspaper. He scoops the eggs onto a plate and sets it in front of her, saying, "Voila, madame, extra crispy." And she shakes her head and says something I can't hear, but she's smiling. And he leans down and kisses her once on the forehead. It's a nice thing to see. I'm glad I was looking. Izzy follows me to the door with my gloves, grinning at me and showing off the gap between her two front teeth. A feeling of vertigo overwhelms me when I look at her, a nauseous feeling lashing in my stomach, but I take a deep breath and think of counting steps, think of running leaps and my dream of flying. 1, 2, 3, jump! You forgot your glove. Lisping, smiling, wisps of golden hair. What would I do without you? I crouch down and squeeze her in a hug, as I do seeing our whole life together. Her tiny infant toes and scalp that smelled like baby powder. The first time she tottered over to me. The first time she rode a bike and fell and scraped her knee. And when I saw all that blood on her, I almost died from fright and I carried her all the way home. And I see beyond it, strangely, glimpses of her in the other direction. Izzy grown tall and gorgeous with one hand resting on a steering wheel, laughing. Izzy wearing a long green dress and picking her way in heels toward a waiting limousine on her way to prom. Izzy loaded down with books as the snow swirls around her, ducking into a dorm, her hair a golden flame against the white. She squeals and squirms away. I can't breathe! You're crushing me! Sorry, Fizzer. I reach back and unhook my grandma's bird necklace. Izzy's eyes go huge and round. Turn around, I say, and for once she's totally quiet and does what I say with no complaints, standing perfectly still, while I lift her hair and fix the charm around her neck. She turns back to me, her face very serious, waiting for my opinion. I give the necklace a tug. It falls halfway down her chest, sitting just to the right of her heart. It looks good on you, Fizz. Are you giving it to me? For real, real? Or just for today? Her voice is a hush like we're discussing state secrets. It looks better on you anyway. I put a finger on her nose and she twirls away with her hands in the air like a ballerina. Thanks, Thammy! Except, of course, it comes out Thammy. Be good, Izzy. I stand up, throat tight, and aching in my whole body. I have to fight the urge to get down on my knees and squeeze her again. She puts her hands on her hips like our mom does, mock offended, sticking her nose in the air. I'm always good. I'm the best. The best of the best. She's already turned around, running and sliding in her slippered feet back toward the kitchen, yelling, "Look what Thammy gave me!" with one hand cupped around the charm. Tears are blurring my vision so I can't see her clearly, just the pink of her pajamas and the golden ring of her hair. Outside, the cold burns my lungs and makes the pain in my throat worse. I take a deep breath, sucking in the smells of wood fires and gasoline. The sun is beautiful, long and low on the horizon like it's stretching itself, like it's shaking off a nap. And I know underneath this weak winter light is the promise of days that last until 8 p.m., and pool parties, and the smell of chlorine and burgers on the grill. And underneath that is the promise of trees lit up in red and orange like flames and spiced cider and frost that melts away by noon. Layers upon layers of life, always something more, new, deeper. It makes me feel like crying, but Lindsay's already parked in front of the house, waving her arms and yelling, "What are you doing?" So instead, I just keep walking, one foot in front of the other, one, two, three, and I think about letting go of the trees and the grass and sky and the red streaked clouds on the horizon, letting it all drop away from me like a veil. Maybe there will be something spectacular underneath. A Miracle of Chance and Coincidence, Part 1.
And so I was like, listen, I don't care that it's stupid. I don't care that it's like a holiday invented by Hallmark or whatever.
Lindsay's rattling on about Patrick, punctuating her story by tapping the steering wheel with the heel of her hand. She's perfectly in control again. Hair swept back in a ponytail, just messy enough. Lip gloss slicked on, a mist of Burberry Brit gold clinging to the puffy jacket she's wearing. It's strange to see her this way after last night, but at the same time I'm glad. She's cruel and frightened and proud and insecure, but she's still Lindsay Edgecombe, the girl who freshman year took a key to Marie Tinsley's brand new BMW after Marie called her a froshy prostitute. Even though Marie had just been voted prom queen and nobody, not even people in her own grade, would stand up to her. And she's still my best friend. And despite everything, I still respect her. And I know that however wrong she's been about a million things, about other people, about herself, she'll figure it out. I know from the way she looked last night, with the shadows making a hollow of her face. Maybe it's just wishful thinking, but I like to believe, on some level or in some world, what happened last night matters, that it didn't totally vanish. Sometimes I'm afraid to go to sleep because of what I'm leaving behind. Thinking about Kent's words makes shivers dance up and down my spine. This is the first time in my life I've ever missed kissing someone. The first time I've ever woken up feeling like I've lost something important.
Maybe he's freaking out because he's too into you.
Elodie pipes up from the backseat.
Don't you think, Sam?
Uh-huh. I'm savoring my coffee, drinking it slowly. A perfect morning. Exactly how I would have chosen it. Perfect coffee, perfect bagel, riding around in the car with two of my best friends, not really talking about anything, not really trying to talk about anything, just babbling on about the same stuff we always do, enjoying one another's voices. The only thing that's missing is Allie. I suddenly get the urge to drive around Ridgeview for a little bit longer. Partly I don't want the ride to end. Partly I just want to look at everything one last time. Linz, can we stop at Starbucks? I kind of want a latte. I take a few gulps of my coffee, trying to drain it to make this more believable. She raises her eyebrows.
You hate Starbucks.
Yeah, well, I got a sudden craving.
You said it tastes like dog pee strained through a trash bag.
Elodie gulps her coffee.
Ew, hello. Drinking. Eating.
She waves her bagel dramatically. Lindsay raises both hands.
That's a direct quote.
If I'm late to Poli Sci one more time, I swear I'll get detention for life,
Elodie says.
And you'll miss the chance to suck face with Muffin before first,
Lindsay says, snickering.
What about you?
Elodie pegs her with a piece of bagel and Lindsay squeals.
It's a miracle you and Patrick haven't fused faces yet.
Come on, Lindsay, please. I bat my eyelashes at her, then twist around to Elodie.
Pretty please.
Lindsay sighs heavily, locking eyes with Elodie in the rearview mirror. She flicks on her turn indicator. I clap my hands and Elodie groans.
Sam gets to do what she wants today,
Lindsay says.
After all, it's her big day.
She emphasizes the word big, then starts cracking up. Elodie picks up on it right away.
I would say it's Rob's big day, actually.
We can only hope.
Lindsay leans over and elbows me.
Ew,
I say, perverts. Lindsay's on a roll now.
It's going to be a long day.
A hard one,
Elodie adds. Lindsay sprays some coffee out of her mouth and Elodie shrieks. They're both snorting and laughing like maniacs. Very funny, I say, looking out the window, watching the houses begin to stream together as we come into town. Very mature. But I'm smiling, feeling happy and calm, thinking, you have no idea. There's a small parking lot behind the Starbucks in town, and we get the last spot, Lindsay slamming into it and nearly taking out the side mirrors of the two cars on either side of us, but still yelling,
Gucci, baby, Gucci,
which she claims is Italian for perfect. In my head, I've been saying goodbye to everything. All these places I've seen so often, I start to ignore them. The deli on the hill with perfect chicken cutlets, and the trinket store where I used to buy thread to make friendship bracelets, and the realtors and the dentists, and the little garden where Steve King put his tongue in my mouth in seventh grade and I was so surprised I bit down. I can't stop thinking about how strange life is, about Kent and Juliet and even Alex and Anna and Bridget and Mr. Otto and Ms. Winters. About how complex and connected everything is, all threaded together like some vast, invisible netting, and how sometimes you can think you're doing the right thing, but it's actually terrible, and vice versa. We head into Starbucks and I get a latte. Elodie gets a brownie, even though she's just eaten, and Lindsay puts a stuffed bear on her head and then orders a water without blinking while the barista stares at her like she's crazy. And I can't help but throw my arms around her, and she says,
Save it for the bedroom, babe,
making the old woman behind us inch away. We come out laughing, and I almost drop my coffee. Sarah Grundle's brown Chevrolet is idling in the parking lot. She's drumming her hands on the wheel, checking her watch, waiting for a spot to open up. The last spot,
the spot we took.
You've got to be freaking kidding me, I say out loud. She'll definitely be late now. Lindsay catches me staring and misunderstands me.
I know. If I had that car, I totally wouldn't rock it past the driveway. I think I'd rather walk.
No, I shake my head, realizing I can't explain. As we pass, Sarah rolls her eyes and sighs, like, finally. The humor of the situation hits me, and I start to laugh.
How's the latte?
Lindsay asks as we climb back in the car. Like dog pee strained through a trash bag, I say. We roll out of the spot, giving Sarah a little beep, and she huffs and zooms in as soon as we're out of the way.
What's her drama?
Elodie asks.
PNS, Lindsay says. Parking need syndrome.
As we pull out of the parking lot, it occurs to me that maybe it's not so complicated at all. Most of the time, 99% of the time, you just don't know how and why the threads are looped together, and that's okay. Do a good thing and something bad happens. Do a bad thing and something good happens. Do nothing and everything explodes. And very, very rarely, by some miracle of chance and coincidence, butterflies beating their wings just so, and all the threads hanging together for a minute, you get the chance to do the right thing. Here's the last thing that occurs to me as Sarah recedes in the rearview mirror, slamming out of the car, jogging across the parking lot. If you're one tardy away from missing out on a big competition, you should probably make your coffee at home. When we get to school, I have a few things to take care of in the Rose Room, so I split up with Elodie and Lindsay. Then, because I'm already late, I decide to skip the rest of first period. I wander through the halls and the campus, thinking how strange it is that you can live your whole life in one place and never really look at it. Even the yellow walls that we used to call the vomit hallways strike me as pretty now. The slender, bare trees in the middle of the quad, elegant and sparse, just waiting for snow. For most of my life, it's always seemed like the school day dragged on forever, except during quizzes and tests, when the seconds seemed to trip over themselves trying to run away quickly. Today it's like that. No matter how badly I want for everything to go slowly, time is pouring away, hemorrhaging. I've barely made it into the second question of Mr. Tierney's quiz before he's yelling, "Time!" and giving all of us his fiercest scowl. And I have to turn in my quiz, only partially completed. I know it doesn't matter, but I've given it my best shot anyway. I want to have one last day when everything is normal. A day like a million other days I've had. A day when I turn in my chem quiz and worry about whether Mr. Tierney will ever make good on his threat to call BU. But I don't regret the quiz for long. I'm past regretting things now. When it's time for math, I head down early, feeling calm. I slide into my seat a few minutes before the bell and take out my math textbook, centering it perfectly on my desk. I'm the first student to arrive. Mr. Daimler comes over and leans against my desk, smiling at me. I notice for the first time that one of his incisors is extra pointy, like a vampire's.
What's this, Sam?
He gestures at my desk.
3 minutes early and actually prepared for class? Are you turning over a new leaf?
Something like that, I say evenly, folding my hands on top of my textbook.
So, how's Cupid Day treating you?
He pops a mint in his mouth and leans closer. It grosses me out, like he thinks he can seduce me with fresh breath.
Any big romantic plans tonight? Got someone special to cozy up next to?
He raises his eyebrows at me. A week ago, this would have made me swoon. Now I feel totally cold. I think about how rough his face was on mine, how heavy he felt. But it doesn't make me angry or afraid. I fixate on his hemp necklace, which is, as always, peeking out from under his shirt collar. For the first time, he strikes me as kind of pathetic. Who wears the same thing for 8 straight years? That would be like if I insisted on wearing the candy necklaces I loved when I was in 5th grade.
We'll see, I say, smiling. What about you? Are you going to be all by your lonesome? Table for one?
He leans forward even more, and I stay perfectly still, willing myself not to pull away.
Now, why would you assume that?
He winks at me, obviously thinking that this is my version of flirting, like I'm going to offer to keep him company or something. I smile even wider.
Because if you had a real girlfriend, I say, quietly but clearly so he can hear every word perfectly, you wouldn't be hitting on high school girls.
Mr. Daimler sucks in a breath and jerks backward so quickly he almost falls off the desk. People are coming into class now, chattering and comparing roses, ignoring us. We could be talking about a homework assignment or a quiz grade. He stares at me, his mouth opening and shutting. No words come out. The bell rings. Mr. Daimler shakes his shoulders and stumbles away from the desk, still staring at me. Then he turns a complete circle as if he's lost. Finally, he clears his throat.
Okay, everyone.
His voice breaks and he coughs. When he speaks again, it's a bark.
Everyone! Seats! Now!
I have to bite the edge of my hand to keep from cracking up. Mr. Daimler shoots me a look of total disgust, which makes the urge to laugh even harder to resist. I look away, turning toward the door, right at the moment that Kent McFuller walks through it. We lock eyes, and in that second, it's like the classroom folds in two, and all of the distance disappears between us. A zooming, rushing feeling comes over me like I'm being beamed up into his bright green eyes. Time collapses, too, and we're back on my porch in the snow, his warm fingers brushing my neck, the soft pressure of his lips, the whisper of his voice in my ear. Nothing exists but him.
Mr. McFuller, care to take a seat?
Mr. Daimler's voice is cold.
Kent turns away from me, and the moment is lost. He mumbles a quick sorry to Mr. Daimler and then heads for his seat. I turn around, following him with my eyes. I love the way he slides into his seat without touching his desk. I love the way when he pulls out his math textbook, a bunch of crumpled sketches come with it. I love the way he keeps nervously fiddling with his hair, running his hands through it, even though it swings back into his eyes immediately.
Ms. Kingston, if I could trouble you for just a second of your precious time and attention.
When I turn back to the front of the room, Mr. Daimler is glaring at me.
I guess for a second, I say loudly, and everybody laughs.
Mr. Daimler folds his mouth into a thin, white line, but doesn't say anything else. I flip open my math textbook, but I can't focus. I drum my fingers on the underside of the desk, feeling antsy and exhilarated now that I've seen Kent. I wish I could tell him exactly how I feel. I wish I could explain it somehow, that he could know. I watch the clock anxiously. I can't wait for the Cupids to come. Kent McFuller is getting an extra rose today. After class, I wait for Kent in the hall, butterflies making a mess of my stomach. When he comes out, he's carefully holding the rose I've sent him, like he's afraid it will break. He glances up, serious and thoughtful, his eyes searching my face.
You going to tell me what this is about?
He doesn't smile, but there's a teasing lilt to his voice, and his eyes are bright. I decide to tease him right back, even though being so close to him is making it hard to think. I don't know what you're talking about. He holds the rose out and flips the note open so I can read it, though, of course, I know what it says. Tonight, leave your phone on and your car out, and be my hero.
Mysterious, I say, holding back a smile.
He looks 10 times more adorable when he's worried.
Secret admirer?
Not so secret.
His eyes are still roving over my face like there's the answer to a puzzle written there, and I have to look away to keep from grabbing him and pulling him toward me. He pauses.
I'm having a party tonight, you know.
I know, I rush on. I mean, I heard.
So?
I give up on playing with him. Listen, I may need you to pick me up from somewhere. 20 minutes tops. I wouldn't ask unless it was important. He crooks one side of his mouth into a smile.
What's in it for me?
I lean forward so my mouth is inches away from the perfect shell of his ear. The smell of him, freshly cut grass and mint, is addictive. I'll tell you a secret.
Now?
Later. I pull back. Otherwise, I won't be able to stop myself from kissing his neck. I don't know what's wrong with me. I was never like this with Rob. I can barely keep my hands to myself around Kent. Maybe dying a few times messes with your hormones or something. I kind of like it. His face gets serious again.
What you wrote here?
He fingers the note, folding it and unfolding it, his eyes dazzling, swirling with gold.
The last bit, the hero thing. How did you?
My heart is beating frantically, and for 1 second, I think he knows. I think he remembers. The silence is heavy between us. Everything past and remembered and forgotten and wanted swinging there like a pendulum. How did I what? I can barely breathe the words. He sighs and shakes his head, gives me a weak smile.
Nothing. Forget it. It's stupid.
Oh. I realize I've been holding my breath and I exhale, looking away so he won't see how disappointed I am. Thanks for your rose, by the way. Of all the roses I've gotten, it's the only one I kept. It's my favorite, I'd said, when Marion Sykes delivered it to me. She looked up at me, startled, and then looked around as though I couldn't possibly be talking to her. When she realized I was, she blushed and smiled.
You have so many, she said shyly.
The problem is I can never keep them alive, I said. I have like a black thumb.
You have to cut the stems on an angle, she said eagerly, then blushed again. My sister taught me that. She used to like to garden.
She turned away, biting her lip.
You should take them, I said.
She stared at me for a second as though suspecting a joke.
Like, to keep?
She said, reminding me of Izzy. I'm telling you, I can't have any more flower homicides on my conscience, I said.
You could take them home. Do you have a vase?
She paused for a fraction of a second more and then broke into a dazzling smile, transforming her whole face.
I'll keep them in my room, she said.
Kent cocks one eyebrow.
How did you know that I'm the one who sent it?
Come on, I roll my eyes. No one else draws weird cartoons for a living. He puts a hand on his chest, acting offended.
Not for a living, for the love of it. Besides, they're not weird.
Whatever. Then thanks for your totally normal note.
You're welcome.
He grins. We're standing close enough that I can feel the heat coming off him.
So, are you going to be my knight in shining armor, or what?
Kent does a little bow.
You know I can't resist a damsel in distress.
I knew I could count on you. The hallways are empty now. Everyone is at lunch. For a moment, we just stand there smiling at each other. Then something softens in his eyes and my heart soars. Everything in me feels fluttering and free, like I could take off from the ground at any second.
Music, I think. He makes me feel like music.
Then I think, he's going to kiss me right here, in the math wing of Thomas Jefferson High School, and I almost pass out. He doesn't, though. Instead, he reaches out and touches my shoulder once, lightly. When he removes his fingers, I can still feel them tingling on my skin.
Until tonight, then.
A flicker of a smile.
Your secret better be good.
It's amazing. I promise.
I wish I could memorize every single thing about him. I want to burn him into my mind. I can't believe how blind I was for so long.
I start to back away before I do something wildly inappropriate, like jump on top of him.
Sam!
He stops me. Yeah?
His eyes are doing that searching thing again, and now I understand why he told me before that he could see through me. He's actually been paying attention. I feel like he's reading my mind right now, which is more than a little embarrassing, since most of my thoughts for the moment involve how perfect his lips are. He bites his lip and shuffles his feet a little.
Why me? For tonight, I mean, we haven't really talked in like 7 years.
Maybe I'm making up for lost time. I keep backing away from him, skipping a little.
I'm serious, he says. Why me?
I think of Kent holding my hand in the dark, leading me through rooms crisscrossed with moonlight. I think of his voice lulling me to sleep, carrying me off like a tide. I think of time stilling as he cupped my face and brought his lips to mine.
Trust me, I say.
It can only be you.
Second chances.
Kent's valigram was only the first of several adjustments I made in the Rose Room this morning, and as soon as I enter the cafeteria, I can tell that Rob got his. He breaks away from his friends and lopes up to me before I can even make it over to the lunch line, where I'm planning on ordering a double roast beef sandwich. As always, his stupid Yankees hat is barely balanced on his head, twisted around to the side like he's in some rap video from 1992.
Hey, babe.
He goes to put his arm around me and I step away casually.
Got your rose.
Thanks. I got yours too. He looks around, sees a single rose looped through the handle of my messenger bag, and frowns.
Is that mine?
I shake my head, smiling sweetly. He rubs his forehead. He always does this when he's thinking, like the act of actually using his mind gives him a headache.
What happened to all your roses?
They're in storage, I say, which is kind of true. He shakes his head, letting it go.
So, there's a party to... night.
He trails off, then tips his head and smirks at me.
I thought it would be fun to go for a bit.
He reaches out and clomps a hand on my shoulder, massaging me hard.
Like, you know, foreplay.
Only Rob would think that pounding foamy beer from a keg and screaming at each other counts as foreplay, but I decide to let it go and play along.
Foreplay?
I say as innocently as I can. He obviously thinks I'm being flirtatious. He smiles and tilts his head backward, looking at me through half-narrowed eyes. I used to think it was the cutest thing when he did this. Now it's a bit like watching a linebacker try to samba. He might have all the moves down, but it just doesn't look right.
You know, he says quietly, I really liked what you wrote in your note.
Did you? I make my voice a purr, thinking about what I scrawled out this morning. You don't have to wait for me anymore.
So, I was thinking I'd get to the party at like 10, stay for an hour or two.
He shrugs and adjusts his hat, back to business now that he got the flirting out of the way. I feel suddenly tired. I'd been planning to mess with Rob a little to get back at him for not paying attention, for not being there, for not caring about anything except partying and lacrosse and how he looks in his stupid Yankees hat. But I can't keep up the game anymore.
I don't really care what you do, Rob.
He hesitates.
This was not the answer he was expecting.
You're sleeping over tonight, though, right?
I don't think so.
His hand flies up to his forehead again, more rubbing.
But you said...
I said you didn't have to wait for me anymore. And you don't. I suck in a deep breath. 1, 2, 3, jump.
This isn't working out, Rob. I want to break up.
He takes a step backward. His face goes completely white, and then he turns bright red from the forehead down like someone's filling him with Kool-Aid.
What did you say?
I said I'm breaking up with you.
I've never done anything like this before, and I'm surprised by how easy I'm finding it. Letting go is easy. It's all downhill. I just don't think it's working out.
But, he sputters at me. The confusion on his face is replaced by rage. You can't break up with me.
I unconsciously shuffle backward, crossing my arms.
Why's that?
He looks at me like I'm the dumbest person alive.
You, he says, almost spitting the word, cannot break up with me.
Then I get it. Rob does remember. He remembers that in sixth grade, he said I wasn't cool enough for him, remembers it, and still believes it. Any sympathy I still feel for him vanishes in that moment, and as he's standing there, bright red, with his fists clenched, it amazes me how ugly I find him.
I can do it, I say calmly. I just did.
And I waited for you. I waited for you for months.
He turns away and mutters something I don't hear.
What?
He looks back at me, his face twisted with disgust and anger. This cannot be the same person who, a week ago, nestled against my shoulder and told me I was his personal blanket. It's like his face has dropped away and there's a totally different face underneath.
I said I should have screwed Gabby Haynes when she asked me to over break, he says coldly.
Something flares in my stomach, leftover pain or pride, but it passes quickly enough and is replaced again by a feeling of calm. I'm already gone from here, already flying over this, and I can suddenly understand exactly what Juliet feels, must have felt for some time. Thinking about her brings my strength back, and I even manage to smile.
It's never too late for second chances, I say sweetly, and then I walk away to have my last lunch with my best friends.
10 minutes later, when I'm finally sitting down at our usual table, scarfing an enormous roast beef sandwich with mayonnaise and a plate full of fries, hungrier than I've been in a long time, and Juliet comes through the cafeteria, I see she has placed a single rose in the empty water bottle that is strapped to the side of her backpack. She's looking around, too, her face cutting the curtain of her hair in two, checking each and every table she passes, searching, looking for clues. Her eyes are bright and alert. She's chewing her lip, but she doesn't look unhappy. She looks alive. My heart skips a beat. This is the important thing. As she weaves past our table, I see a folded note fluttering just under the petals of her rose, and even though I'm too far away to read it, I can see what's written there clearly. Even when I close my eyes, a single phrase. It's never too late.
So, what's up with you today?
Lindsay asks on the way to the country's best yogurt. We've almost reached the row, the line of small shops clustered at the crest of the hill like mushrooms. The blanket of dark clouds is being drawn over the horizon inch by inch, bringing the promise of snow.
What do you mean?
We're walking arm in arm, trying to stay warm. I wanted Allie and Elodie to come along, but Elodie had a Spanish test, and Allie insisted that if she missed another English class, she'd probably get suspended. I didn't make a big deal out of it. A day like any other.
I mean, why are you acting so weird?
I'm trying to formulate an answer, and Lindsay goes on.
Like, zoning out at lunch and stuff?
She bites her lip.
I got this text from Amy Weiss.
Yeah?
Amy Weiss is obviously crazy, and I would never believe anything she says, especially about you.
Lindsay qualifies quickly. Obviously. I say, amused, pretty sure I know where this is headed.
But...
Lindsay sucks in a deep breath and says in a rush,
she says she was talking to Steve Waitman, who was talking to Rob, who said that you broke up.
Lindsay shoots a glance at me and forces a laugh. I told her it was bullshit, obviously.
I pause, choosing my words carefully. It's not bullshit. It's true. Lindsay stops walking and stares.
What?
I broke up with him at lunch. She shakes her head like she's trying to dislodge the words from her brain.
And, were you planning on sharing this little piece of news at some point? With your best friends? Or were you just counting on it to make the rounds eventually?
I can tell she's really hurt. Listen, Lindsay, I was going to tell you. She presses her hands to both ears, still shaking her head.
I don't understand. What happened? You guys were supposed to... I mean, you told me you wanted to. Tonight.
I sigh. This is why I didn't want to tell you, Linz. I knew you'd make a big deal out of it.
That's because it is a big deal.
Lindsay's so outraged, she's not even paying attention as we pass Hunan Kitchen. She's too busy glaring at me like she expects me to suddenly turn blue or combust, like I could never be trusted again. It occurs to me she's really going to feel that way after I do what I'm about to do, but it can't be helped. I turn to her, putting my arms on her shoulders. Wait here for a second, okay? She blinks at me. Where are you going? I have to stop in Hunan Kitchen for a second. I brace myself, waiting for her to freak out. I kind of have something for Anna Cartulo. I'm prepared for her to scream or stalk off or throw gummy bears at me or something, but instead her face goes totally blank, like the power switch has been flipped off. I'm kind of worried she may be going into shock, but the opportunity is too good to pass up. 2 minutes, I say. I promise. I duck into Hunan Kitchen before Lindsay and her attitude can come back online. A bell jingles on the door as I walk in. Alex looks up, worried for a second, and then plasters a smile on his face.
What's up, Sam?
He drawls. Idiot. I ignore him and go straight to Anna. She has her head bent, pushing the food around her plate. It's a lot safer than eating it, that's for sure. Hey. I'm nervous for some reason. There's something unsettling about her quietness, the way she lifts her eyes and stares at me with no expression. It reminds me of Juliet. I just came by to give you something.
Give me something?
She curls her lip back, skeptical, and the resemblance to Juliet is no longer so strong. She must think I'm crazy. As far as she knows, we've never exchanged a word in our lives, and I can only imagine what she thinks I want to give her. Alex is looking back and forth from Anna to me, as confused as she is. I'm aware of Lindsay watching me through the grimy window, and the fact that three people are staring at me like I've lost it is a little overwhelming. I reach into my bag, hands trembling a little bit. Yeah, listen, I know it's weird. I can't really explain it, but I pull out a big book of M.C. Escher sketches and put it on the table next to the bowl of sesame chicken or orange beef or cooked cat or whatever. Anna freezes, staring at the book like it's going to bite her. It just seemed like the kind of thing you'd like, I say quickly, already backing away from the table. Now that the hard part is over, I feel 1,000 times better. There's over 200 drawings. You could even hang some of them up if you had a place to put them. Something tenses in Anna's face. She's still staring at the book on the table, her hands resting on her thighs. I can see how tightly she's curling her fists. I'm just about to turn and jet out the door when she glances up. Our eyes meet. She doesn't say anything, but her mouth relaxes. It's not quite a smile, but it's close, and I take it as a thank you. I hear Alex say,
"What was that about?"
And then I'm out the door, the bell sounding a shrill note behind me. Lindsay's still standing there, exactly as I left her, eyes dull. I know she's been watching through the window.
Now
I know you've gone crazy, she says.
I'm telling you, I don't know what you're talking about. I feel exhilarated now that it's over with. Come on, I'm fiending me some yogurt. Lindsay doesn't budge.
Lost it. Flipped your lid, gone bat shit.
Since when do you bring Anna Cartulo presents? Listen, it's not like I got her a friendship bracelet or something. Since when do you even talk to Anna Cartulo? I sigh. I can tell she's not going to give up on this. I talked to her for the first time a couple days ago, all right? Lindsay's still staring like the world is melting away before her eyes. I know the feeling. She's actually pretty nice. I mean, I think you might like her if... Lindsay makes a high-pitched squealing noise and claps her hands over her ears again like the very words are torture. She keeps on shrieking like this while I sigh and check my watch, waiting for her to finish her performance. Eventually, she calms down, her squealing dying away to a gurgling noise in the back of her throat. She squints at me. I can't help but giggle. She looks like a total freak.
Are you done? I ask.
Are you back?
She peels one hand off her ear tentatively, experimenting. Is who back?
Samantha Emily Kingston, my best friend, my heterosexual life partner.
She leans forward and raps once on my forehead with her knuckles.
Instead of this weird, lobotomized, boyfriend-dumping, Anna Cartulo-liking pod who's impersonating her?
I roll my eyes. You don't know everything about me, you know?
I apparently don't know anything about you.
Lindsay crosses her arms. I tug on the sleeve of her jacket and she trudges forward reluctantly. I can tell she's actually upset. I put my arms around her and squeeze. She's so much shorter than I am that I have to take mini shuffling steps so our paces are matched up. But I let her set the rhythm. You know what my favorite flavor of yogurt is? I say, hoping to appease her. Lindsay heaves a sigh.
Double chocolate?
She grumbles, but she's not pushing me off her, which is a good sign.
With crushed peanut butter cups and Cap'n Crunch cereal?
And I know you know what size I'm going to get. We're at the door to the country's best yogurt now, and I can already smell the deliciously sweet, chemically aroma wafting out to us. It's like the smell of the bread baking at Subway. You know it's not the way nature or God intended it to smell, but something about it is addictive. Lindsay looks at me from the corner of her eye, and I pull my arms off her. Her expression is so mournful it's funny, and I choke down another laugh.
Better be careful, Miss Jumbo Queen, she says, tossing her hair. All that artificial yumminess is going straight to your hips.
But her mouth is crooked up into a smile, and I know she's forgiven me.